It was the moment we've been waiting for all season. Meredith and Derek together at last. But will it last? Stay tuned and we think you'll like the answer. You're listening to the official Grey's Anatomy podcast hosted by ABC.com. Hello everyone and welcome to the last podcast of the season. We have a lot of details to cover, so we're just going to jump right into things. Executive producers Shonda Rhimes and Betsy Beers give us some delicious tidbits about the two-hour season finale entitled Freedom.
Hi, this is Shonda.
This is Betsy.
This is Grey's Anatomy.
And this is the final podcast of the season.
The post-finale wrap-up.
Post-finale wrap-up, which sounds almost like a sporting event.
If and you're in a weird to this, way it was. I hope that you've already watched the finale.
It's true, because if you're listening to this and you haven't, then there are going to be some surprises that you probably will hear about here. So you might want to watch it.
Might be a little bit bummed.
You might. But nobody wants to listen to this blather. What we really want to talk about is this season finale.
Which is called Freedom.
Why is it called Freedom, Shonda?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. First of all, I have this whole theory, which I don't think it ever really pans out in the show, but I have this whole theory in the beginning stages of writing the episode that I was going to base the entire episode on when you go to see Michelangelo's date. This is going to sound pretentious, but I don't mean it to, because I've only been to Italy once, so it's not like I'm some, you know, Italian going snob. But when you go to Italy and you go to see Michelangelo's David, there are these statues which are basically prisoners encased in marble, like breaking out of marble. And they're sort of half carved and half still just big marble lumps. And I think they're called Prisoners of the Rock.
Yep.
So my whole idea of this episode was that with Cement Boy and with Meredith and her issues with her mother, the whole episode was sort of going to be called Prisoners of the Rock. But lo and behold, when I went on iTunes to search for a song called Prisoners of the Rock, apparently nobody has made a song called Prisoners of the Rock.
Which is actually just a word to everybody out there who's writing songs. It's a good title. Think about it.
There were just no songs that had the title. And there were no songs that were called like Rock Prisoner or Prisoner with a Rock. Nothing to help
just
me.
Just like Rock of Ages.
And yeah. Yeah. You know, or just like The Prisoner. Nothing that really gave me what I wanted. And I really started to think, like, what is this episode about in a lot of ways? And for everybody, it's about sort of breaking free. Cement Boy finally gets free of his cement and gets kissed by the girl. Callie breaks free of her fears and kisses Erica. Meredith obviously breaks free of her entire life.
George breaks free.
Goes, takes stand for Derek. George breaks free of being an intern and has the opportunity to take his test.
Alex in a really sad and different way.
Breaks
free of Ava.
Ava breaks free of sanity, yeah. I like to say.
That's true, and thus he breaks free of Ava.
Yeah. Izzy sort of frees herself by managing to effectively handle the Ava-Alex situation.
Phone.
Christina breaks free in her own way of the hand that Erica Hahn has had on the back of her neck since the beginning of the season. Everybody breaks free.
And actually, Sloan breaks free by being a whore, right?
A little bit. Just a little tiny,
tiny
bit.
Tiny, tiny bit.
He peeks his head out of boredom. Richard goes home to his wife. Bailey breaks free of the clinic. Beth, you know, lives, which is breaking free of, well, having a brain tumor. So I went with the idea of freedom. And, of course, you know, George Michael has a song. Little ditty called Freedom.
There you go.
And that's what it came from.
One of the things which is great about the episode is the kisses at the end. I mean,
the whole
sort of like cycle of kissing.
There's a lot of kissing in this episode. We were really trying to end the season on a hopeful note. Last season, if you remember, my mantra for the end of the season was burn it all down. This year, I wanted us to be looking forward into the future and feel a little bit hopeful for our people. And the kisses seemed the best way to do that. The writers on set, you know, who go to oversee the episodes with Rob, our director, we called them kiss captains if they were going to be there on set on a day that the kiss was going to happen. Because they were charged with, if I couldn't be there myself, charged with making sure that the kiss, whichever kiss it was spectacular. So
I think they did actually a really good job.
I think so. I think
you, though, actually were present for a few of the kisses,
I was present for what I like to call, as watching it being shot anyway, and the number of ways in which Rob Korn, Boss McBossy, shot it, the kiss to end all kisses, which was Meredith and Derek, who were in a field with a green screen. That was green screen. That wasn't really Seattle.
That wasn't really Seattle. We didn't go to Seattle, by the way.
At a field in the cold in the middle of the night with a green screen on a wooden turntable being spun around with candles around them, kissing. Like, it was like a big,
pretty romantic,
major, major kiss. They kissed all night long. And they're very professional about it. It's very funny. Like, they're very, like, casual, casual, casual. And then you say, go. And they kiss really passionately. And then they both pull back. And they, like, go back to talking about whatever they're talking about. It's charming. The other kiss that I was there for was the Alex-Izzy kiss.
Yeah.
Which was really important to me because I wanted it to be really earned in terms of Alex's pain, which I felt was... I mean, he did a beautiful job. I've never seen anybody cry and kiss and kiss. I mean, it's just beautiful. On top of which, I wanted to make sure that the kiss felt heartbreaking. Like, with Meredith and Derek, you want it to feel hopeful and like a new day. And with Alex and Izzy, you want that kiss to feel heartbreaking. And with George and Lexi, you know, it's a peck on the lips. But for her, it has all the import in the world. And we wanted to really make sure that you got the power of it for her while getting the casualness of it for him. With the Chief and Adele, which was one of my favorites, because if you notice, there's a cut, you cut back to them and they're kissing, and he's like constantly sort of pulling her in, like he's trying to almost like enfold himself into her in this really sweet, adorable I love my wife way, which I thought was wonderful.
That's like a kiss of total joyous contentment.
Yeah, you know? They had very sweet kissing. It was adorable. And then Callie and Erica, who had to kiss for real for both of them, was something that they'd never kissed girls on screen before, I don't think, and both of them were worried about getting it right and making it look good and also being really true to their characters, mm-hmm. and being making sure that it felt romantic. But they're both very sort of technical, smart actresses, and they talked about it a lot beforehand, and then like you could watch the dailies and sort of watch them talking about it in the middle, sort of like, was that good for you, was that, like, they were really trying to make sure that it felt romantic. And also for Callie's character, especially, what you know about her is that this is not something she's used to or sure she's ready to do, but she's making this big leap. So you also wanted to feel both the passion and the fear involved in making such a leap, and then watch that turn to something else, which I love the moment when Erica puts her hands up to Callie's face and sort of pulls back, and for a second you think, oh dear, and then she leans in and kisses her again. It's really charming.
The other thing probably that a lot of people are... certainly is something that has been discussed with people that I know since we saw the episode, mm-hmm. is the last moment in which actually Derek walks away and he says, stay here, don't move, I'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
And
stay here, don't move, wait for me.
Thank you. You can tell that she wrote it, and I just watched it a few times. See, that's the big difference. I could really make it sound stupid. What I love about the end is it's not the obvious romantic quote-unquote end.
There was a lot of pressure from a lot of sides, including in the writer's room, that maybe we should just end on them kissing. And I was like, that's not the point. The point of the episode, the 2 hours, is not that Meredith gets her man. The point of the episode to me was that Meredith, standing in that field alone, and she has a slightly sort of freaked out expression on her face, which is, I've done the thing that I've been most scared to do. What happens next? But also, for me, her standing in that field alone, sort of whole, in this field of candles that she's built, after he's gone away to do the right thing, when everything is sort of said and done, to me, she is free. Like, mm-hmm. And I felt like I wasn't going to get the same grown-up idea of her being free if we'd ended on just them kissing. Because freedom is not the kiss. Freedom is what happens after.
Well, I think that's actually really well put. And I also think there were a couple of people that said to me, you know, but Derek walks away. And my whole thing was like, it's really, really important that Derek walks away, because so much of what Derek's been about and her lack of faith in him was about not doing the right thing and about kissing Rose and about having a wife he didn't talk about. And he does the most amazingly straightforward thing a man can do, which is he looks at her and says, basically, I want to do more, but I can't do more until it's clean.
And what I love about it, about that whole idea, is that we've watched Meredith, you know, really grow in these past 6 episodes. Mm-hmm. I mean, really sort of struggle through her demons and grow. And you want to feel like Derek has grown as well, because
exactly.
He's not blameless. As we've said before, there's nothing blameless about Derek in all of this. And he definitely takes a journey of his own throughout the episode, but we see less of it because we're sort of with Meredith for most of her journey. So we see less of his journey. And for me to really believe that this was going to be Meredith and Derek getting together for good, I needed to know that he was going to go do the right thing with Rose.
Especially after the fact that he loses faith about half, three quarters of the way through the episode. He loses faith in himself. And it's that amazing moment with Rose where he says, nothing I do will ever be, fail her, will ever be good enough. I think it's so much about actually him coming back to the spirit of the episode before, where she's fully pessimistic and he's very romantic. And Derek in his soul is very romantic.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
he's an optimist.
But failing at something for the first time, I think as a character, was incredibly difficult for him. And getting through that and moving through that and seeing that Meredith is still there, I think is transformative.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for those of you who watched and thought, like, oh, now they're going to do something crazy, Derek is not going to be hit by a bus and thus forget that Meredith exists by the time she sees him again or anything like that.
We're not going to cut to 6 months later.
We're not going to cut to 6 months later and he's married to Rose. Yeah, we're not going to find out that Rose is pregnant. Like, none of those things are going to happen.
We actually are committed to the fact.
I can tell you that openly and honestly. None of those things are going to happen.
And by the way, that's a rare moment, so take a photo.
Yeah. Meredith and Derek are getting together for good.
And that's going to be actually, I think, really fun to watch next season.
I'm really excited about
it's a whole different stage of the relationship.
Yeah, the next stage of the relationship and all the possibilities. Because, you know, the thing about Happily Ever After is there's no such thing. Like, you know, Cinderella may have gotten to the castle, but, you know, still had to sleep with the guy and deal with all of his problems and his family and stuff.
And laundry.
Well, I don't think Cinderella had to do laundry.
But she had an experience in scullery. It seems to me like it would have been a great side work for her when she got bored.
She's ruling a country.
Okay, she's ruling a country, but occasionally maybe she likes to wash the occasional blouse just to remind her of where she came from. I don't think it's a bad necessarily idea. But my point is it's not really when you get together with somebody. No, it's not all glamorous because the fact is you have to start dealing with the day-to-day things like they leave the tops off the toothbrush or they don't actually screw the bottles really tightly in the refrigerator. That's a message actually for someone I know, but there's
a whole other level of exciting, sexy, new stuff that we're going to be able to play with them that we're pretty excited about.
Absolutely. And that you get to see the realities, the great realities of being in a relationship, which is true too.
Exactly.
One of the coolest things I think you did in this was the revelation where you realize where Meredith can't figure out how Dr. Wyatt knows that her mom wasn't serious about committing suicide.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things which is actually right in front of you and you don't really think about either, which is, I was with Meredith because I was like, yeah, how the hell do you know? Like, where do you get off? You weren't there. So why don't you shut up? Because she wanted to commit suicide because I felt like hell about it my entire life. And then the reality, then when it dawns her in that conversation with Richard, is amazing.
Yeah. When I sat down to write the opening scene where she's talking to Dr. Wyatt and she tells Dr. Wyatt how her mother tried to kill herself, I was like, she took a scalpel and I started to really think about it, like, how would Ellis try to kill herself? And then I started to think, well, if Ellis really wanted to kill herself, she really would do it. And that's sort of how that whole idea started, because she'd know what to cut. So it was really interesting to sort of take that out of Meredith's hands as something that she'd know from the very beginning and let it be something that she discovers. Because when you're a kid, when you're 5 years old and something like that happens to you, those are not the things you're thinking about.
No.
You know, you're traumatized and in the moment, and that's the story you've built up for the rest of your life. And the idea that her mother said, be extraordinary, and as a child, what she took that to mean is, be like my mother, be a surgeon, be cold and hard, be alone, is very different from what her mother meant, was don't be like me, be extraordinary, which I thought was great.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't talking about surgery. So for me, like, that revelation really made the script have the weight that it needed to have.
I also feel like, in a weird way, it's be extraordinary enough for this man to love you. Like, it's this other, because you figure Ellis is in this horrible place in her head where she's killing herself, where she feels like she's been left. And it's be the woman I'm not. You're right. It's like
be brave.
And be yourself and don't chicken out, which is what Ellis did.
Yeah.
So it's,
be an extraordinary woman.
Which is also what Christina does in this.
Yeah.
Christina actually ends up being herself, which is what's awesome. And she gets
her mojo
back.
I know, because she's been working so hard to sort of be whatever it is that Erica Hahn could possibly need her to be.
Good little obedient bunny.
And then she went through sort of the horrible cycle of depression, of Burke getting her bravery, and then, you know, she's singing like a virgin. And
her strange Tourette's of, like, being truthful to everybody and telling them what she really thinks.
Yeah, telling everybody. And I love that, first of all, what makes her happy is the sparkle pager, because we're very fond of the sparkle pager over here.
Yeah, we actually...
I have a sparkle pager in my office right now.
Yes, she does.
And the very sparkle pager.
By the way, it may be stolen.
Mm-mm. It's in the safe, actually.
Mm.
Don't worry about that.
Damn it. I was going to distract her.
But, you know, I love that Meredith gives her the one thing that could make her happy, which is sort of give her this freedom. And then she's sort of determined throughout the day to just keep going, keep moving forward. She's very respectful of Hahn, even though Hahn's sort of being Hahn to her. She's really planning on this, getting her mojo back. She got on cement boy. Everything is great. They get in the OR. the girl sees her chance and she takes it. And that great moment when Han comes forward and Christina shouts her down is just brilliant. Like, I loved the moment of Sandra Oh very carefully working. And it's not this frenetic, angry thing. It's a total calm until she screams, shut up and let me work. And the look on Han's face is priceless. But for her, it was, you know, for that character, it was, I've earned this. Let me do my thing. And the chief backs her up is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And calls Erica on it. And I love the little spin, the chair spin she gives at the end after the chief says, don't make me regret backing you up. And she gives a little chair spin, which is the cutest thing ever.
But it's also, it is that thing of, look, Han is a crappy teacher. Yeah. Han has been a really crappy teacher. And that hadn't really occurred to me until the chief says, you know, you're a great surgeon, but unless you're a better teacher, you can't work here.
Yeah. She is. She's a brilliant, brilliant surgeon. And she seems like a lovely person to Callie, you know, worthy of love, you know. But as a person who's supposed to be teaching somebody, to simply decide you don't like someone and then abuse them based on that dislike is not being a good teacher.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely
right. Word to you teachers out there, don't do that.
I think probably that's
our public service message.
That was good. I'm glad we did that. Yeah. That was good. Now, I remember a while before this was written, you had a thing about a boy being trapped in concrete.
Well, this is what happened. I was driving from here, where we work, over to ABC for a meeting. When I was singing really loud in the car to Beyonce, because that's my car music, just in case, you know. I know the music show has an identity, but I sing to Beyonce.
Hey, Beyonce.
Anyway, I was singing really loud to Beyonce, which means I really couldn't hear anything because I can't sing well and I sing really loud. And I was changing lanes, and a cement truck cut me off.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah. And the cement truck was churning, like there was cement in it. And I got this idea of, what if that truck had hit me? If the cement had poured into the... And I literally started thinking, if the cement had poured into the car, would I be frozen in the car? Would they be able to get me out of the car? How would they get me to the hospital? What would the cement do to my skin? Would I be able to breathe? What kind of surgery do you do? Do you have to chip the person out of cement? And when I came back to the office after my meeting, the first thing I said to Elizabeth Clavitter, our medical researcher, was, what happens to somebody when they're stuck in cement? And that's how the whole thing started.
Well, and what's interesting about that, too, is there isn't that much research, is there, about what it's like to be stuck in cement? Because the whole
There's
thing I thought was really, really funny about the episode, which is really, really quiet, but most of the evidence has to do with being at the bottom of a river.
Yes, George
basically in cement boots, which I thought was really funny, which is most are drownings. You know, but that's what I found really interesting was when he does come in, and at first, honestly, you don't know what the hell that thing is.
Yeah,
it's just this big old lump of stuff.
It looks a little bit like a dinosaur egg.
You know, it does. It looks a little bit like it's Sesame Street, and you're not really sure what he is.
Yeah.
But as soon as you learn what it is, which is 12 times as terrifying, immediately in your brain, you say, well, how did that happen? Like, what happens to your body? Because the most disturbing thing about Cement Boy to me was how normal it seems up until a particular point.
Yeah.
That he's talking, and Bailey, who apparently has seen every Star Wars movie 58,000 times.
Of course she has.
A good secret fact about Bailey that
yes.
She's a Star Wars nerd. But I think the amazing thing is, like, that we're all standing there and she's talking to the boy and he seems fine, with the exception of the fact that every once in a while Sloane puts some vinegar on an open...
Yeah.
And then you realize what... the catheter issue, where you realize, oh my God, they gotta get the catheter in.
Explode.
And then you start to realize, oh my God, it's gonna move to his heart and he could... It's terrifying because the ramifications are so huge so quickly.
And what was awesome was when I asked the question, what happens to somebody when they're trapped in cement? And Elizabeth went away and did all this research and talked to all these surgeons and got all... What was great was that when she came back, she was like, this is the coolest case ever, because it could happen, and here's why it could happen, and here's how it could happen, and here's what they'd have to do. And to hear all the details, like the water is being slowly leached from your skin by the cement is burning you, literally, the outlines from the cement are burning you from the inside out, your bones are being crushed, you're going to have fasciotomy, which means your muscles are going to swell faster than your skin, so in order to keep your legs from basically exploding, we have to slice them open.
This is the all-star team of surgery.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like...
It was literally like the Super Bowl of surgery.
Pretty much, yes.
The reason we didn't do a car crash with the cement coming in is because I didn't want to have to deal with, like, the trauma and the jaws of life and all that. I wanted it to be kind of, for its own bizarre, stupid way, this whole series of episodes, this whole series of six episodes is about great love. And I wanted it to be an act of love. Like, he jumps into that for the girl.
I think the other thing, too, is Bailey... Seeing Bailey finally figuring out what the heck the solution is for her was
a big
deal. Well, and all the things which have been pulling at Bailey all season, which are the clinic, being chief resident, wanting to be chief resident, getting to be chief resident, her marriage falling apart as opposed to all the work.
Getting to spend time with the child.
Trying to teach the residents.
Yeah, being a good surgeon. I really loved this episode for her because I feel like her, to me, her journey was interesting and kind of subtle. I mean, yes, at the beginning she says she's trying to see the bigger picture, but she looks so tired when George is telling her all the things that she's going to have to do, how she has to do 15 to 20 more hours in the OR, and she can't figure out how the hell she's going to get to be able to do that. And then to sort of watch her show this boy the bigger picture, which then allows her to see the bigger picture herself. And the whole Star Wars speech and the carbonite being just a piece and the whole thing is great. For her to say that what she's realized is that the bigger picture is that she needs to hand over the clinic was, I just thought her speech was heartbreaking when she realized that you have to keep the things you love. And that I love the moment when she says, I can't do everything and have everything. So she has to let something go. And I thought that was great. And I totally related to it.
I think that's true. And I think in a weird way, they all do in this.
Yeah.
But I mean, the chief had to let go of the idea that he could do everything last season. And it took him an entire season mm-hmm. to let go enough to get Adele back.
Yeah.
And Alex, I think, to grow, is going to have to let go of Ava.
And I love that moment when she says to him, I wanted to be healthy for you because I know how hard it is for you to depend on people. Like, that to me was heartbreaking, that she was desperately trying to stay as sane as she possibly could for him. And I love, I mean, for me, like, there are a lot of those things. I love the moment with the chief when, you know, he says to Meredith, I know that I'm the villain in your story, but I'm not a bad man. I love that moment because that is what he is for her. In her story, he is the man who put into motion all the events that have shaped her life from the time she was 3 to now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Her mother, her father, her parents' marriage, who she believes she is, who she is as a surgeon now, is being shaped by him. I think it's really interesting. And really, if you remember that moment and then get into next season, you'll see how that plays out in a way that's going to be really exciting.
Well, and he's also the man who let her retake her intern test.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, like, he's the villain in the story, but he's been trying to make up for being the villain in his mother, in her mother's story in a particular way
forever. Yeah.
And that's where, no, he's not a bad man. He's doing the best job he can. But I think you realize the chief maybe makes mistakes occasionally if you look at George.
Yeah. That's that was a great thing.
That you find out that one point, and poor Lexi with her photographic memory.
And it's that idea that Richard says, you know, he tells Adele, I'm a good man for everybody but you. But the reality of it is he's not necessarily. He's the villain in Meredith's story, and in George's story, he's a bit of the villain. I love that because you adore the chief, and you never think of him as being a bad man. But he's a man who makes mistakes.
And that's part of being in charge. I mean, in fact, you can't always do the right thing all the time, and you try to, and you can try to sleep with a clean conscience. But the fact is, at a particular point, if you're in charge, you're going to make mistakes, and you're also going to make unpopular decisions.
And here's the thing. George has a point in that the chief has given every single person, every one of our interns, as now residents, a second chance except for George. Izzy cut the LVAD wire, and she's back in practicing surgery. Meredith didn't take her intern exam, and he allowed her to take it. Christina, with the Han thing in this very episode.
But with Burke's hand.
With Burke's hand.
In theory, could have been kicked out of the resident
Alex
program.
Alex failed his early boards, and he got to retake those. So there's a sense that everybody's gotten a second chance but George. And George is the kind of guy you don't think of as needing a second chance. He's doesn't have a surgical personality, and he doesn't push. And it never would have occurred to him to push and ask to take the exam again. So he just fails, and that's it, which I think is interesting. Whereas Christina would have dogged the chief until the chief gave her a chance. And the chief would have given Meredith a chance because she's Meredith. Like, I think it's really, really interesting that poor George just always takes it. And he just got done taking it.
Absolutely.
How much do we love Lexi, though, with her, like, crazy? Lexi's dodgy. You know, you think Lexi's,
this
like...
This is the thing. Lexi says she's never
stolen.
She seems
all sweet, but... She busted into the chief's office and stole
something.
Those files and read them all.
Lexi's good at it. She says she never stole a lipstick or whatever she says in the episode where she actually turns out
she steals everything from the hospital.
She furnishes the whole apartment. I suspect, actually, I think Lexi has some sticky fingers.
She's kind of a badass.
I think she does. Yeah. I think she actually, I think you might want Lexi around
but
in a bar fight.
She didn't even think twice about phone. She didn't think twice about busting into the chief's office and stealing those files. Like, not even twice.
No, not twice. But also, what you really, really realize at the end of the episode when he kisses her and she looks absolutely astonished
and happy.
Like her
world has changed, yeah.
You realize she did it so much for him.
Well, she stole for him last time, too.
I know, it's true. She does. She steals for the man she loves.
Don't commit crimes for the man you love.
No, it's not a good idea. Much better to wash blouses. I recommend that. she would wash.
I'm just saying that if you're going to marry a prince and run a country, you probably aren't washing blouses. That messes with the fantasy.
You're probably right. You're probably right. That never occurs to me that there are actually people in the palace who can do the washing.
It's a palace. Do you think that the Queen of England washes her own clothes?
Occasionally for sport. She raises corgis, too. Who the hell knew, you know?
No palace for you.
Clearly, the two of us have different ideas of happily ever after. Mine is clearly rooted in domestic chores, and Shonda actually has a much better grasp on what it's like to run a country. I think that tells you everything you need to know.
Mine is rooted in tiaras. I just feel like
you are. You're totally, totally rooted in tiaras. It's true. I think the tiara thing would
Princess Diaries 2 rented on video.
Nice one. Nicely done.
Let's slip that in.
I think we've talked about a lot of the major issues here.
Yes. One of the things that I think I felt pretty strongly about was the idea that Ava, Rebecca, attempt suicide in the same kitchen where Meredith's mother attempted suicide, because one of the very first images I came up with was the idea that Meredith would walk into her kitchen while dealing with all the stuff that's going on and see that blood on the floor and then start trying to scrub that blood up and sort of be scrubbing that blood long after the blood is gone, because she's not scrubbing the actual blood, she's scrubbing her psychic blood. Ooh, that was deep. She's scrubbing her psychic blood off the floor in that moment. That was really important to me. And I felt like for these two things to be happening sort of simultaneously, for Meredith to be reliving sort of the past of her mother and for Alex to be living this story in the now, for it all to be taking place in that same house, mm-hmm. was very interesting to me. I'm not sure what that means, but I loved the symmetry of it all.
I think symmetry, but it also, I think it's a step along the way of Meredith's healing.
Yes.
Because she actually gets to wash the blood again. And I think that's part of getting her to the part where she realizes why her mother wasn't really serious about killing herself. I think there was something about that being an important step in the stage of actually, I think most people don't get to actually relive a trauma, but the fact that she actually got to deal with it again drives you in the right direction to healing, which I think is good.
I also want to point out that at the end of the episode, when everyone's doing the kissing and the getting together, that everybody, Izzy, Meredith, Adele, Lexi, and under her jacket, Callie, are all wearing shades of red, which to me was, A, generally it's the color that people look prettiest in. But in terms of talking about costumes, we love, it's such a hopeful color, and it's also sort of an empowered color. At the end of season 2, everybody is wearing mourning clothes except for Izzy. They're all wearing, you know, black or navy blue dresses, and Izzy's wearing the pink, mm-hmm. the only person who didn't know she was going to be attending a funeral that day. At the end of season 3, all the men are in tuxedos, and all the girls are wearing like a brownish color, and Christina's the only one dressed in white, which is sad because it's hopeful and the whole thing. But everybody's very muted because what's happening is very muted. And in this one, everybody is wearing these red, hopeful, wonderful colors that sort of speak to where the characters are and to the future. And that was all from the mind of Mimi, our costume designer.
What's going to happen next season on Grey's Anatomy?
I think that we've raised some good questions at the end of this episode.
I think that's true.
What will happen now that Callie has kissed Erica?
What's it going to be like when Meredith and Derek actually get serious about being together? The Chief and Adele, is that going to last?
Alex and Izzy have had this awkward love, heartbreaking pain kiss, does that mean something?
Is there a future there?
Is Lexi ever going to let George know that kiss meant something to her? Will Christina find love?
God, I hope so. Can I say right now, I'd love for Christina to find some love.
I know, me too. She deserves it.
She does deserve it. I think she's had a hard last part of the resident year.
Yeah. Will Sloane ever get his threesome? Will Meredith and Derek ever build the house, or will they just live in a sea of candles?
So we're looking forward to all that. We're looking forward to tuning in and seeing all that.
Will we ever see Rose again?
Good question.
Big question. That might be true.
Absolutely the case.
Yes. We had some great guest cast on this episode, and I want to be sure I'm saying his name right. Jeremy Emekis, mm-hmm. who was our lovely boy encased in cement, who was incredibly patient, because you'd get in that thing and you'd have to be in it for 10 hours straight, and therefore couldn't drink water or go wee.
Talking about needing a catheter. That's all I'm going to say.
We did not. No, he did not need a catheter.
He didn't, but the point is, that's endurance.
That's endurance. And we had the fabulous and amazing Journey Smollett, who
played Beth.
For the story, Beth was the embodiment of true love. Like, her form was the embodiment of true love to me. And so I thought she did an amazing, 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 wonderful job. And we had some awesome, awesome music in the episode.
We actually debuted here a song by Bryn Christopher.
Yes.
Who's a new British sensation, singing sensation. That song has actually been heard in Europe, but has not been heard widely here at all.
You've never heard it.
Called The Quest.
Yes.
And we were very, very excited about that. We also were amazingly fortunate to have the first, I believe the debut of a song from Coldplay.
It wasn't even, it's not, you can't even get it on iTunes yet. Well, now you can, but you couldn't.
But you couldn't before, and that was a huge, hugely exciting thing for us. We thank Alex Patsavis, our music supervisor, for that. And we really, really thank Coldplay for this, because it was an amazing opportunity.
And there were many, many other great songs, which we're really, really proud of.
Yep. So we're gonna take a break for a little bit. We're probably not a very long break.
For a while.
And in the meantime, we hope you have a great summer and you relax and you get all excited and prepare for watching season 5 of Grey's Anatomy on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock.
Yes.
And hopefully you'll have a little bit of time to watch Private Practice, which is gonna be on Wednesday nights
at 9 o'clock.
ABC.
I'm Shonda.
I'm Betsy.
This is Grey's Anatomy.
Thanks, Shonda and Betsy. And thank you for listening, Grey's Anatomy fans. We hope to be back once or twice over the summer to give you all a preview of what's in store for everyone at Seattle Grace Hospital next season. Until then, satiate your appetite for all things Grey at abc.com, where you can rewatch episodes of all your favorite ABC shows in the full episode player.